funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much are you like your neighbors in terms of income, race, and educational attainment? And does it hurt mixed-class communities when those who have achieved middle-class status pick up and move away? Many of us view success as a product of our own initiative, and we like to think of America as a land of unlimited opportunity. But as my guest today will tell us, it matters a great deal where we live and work and go to school in America, so that some communities help to foster prosperity while others create obstacles. David Dante Trout is professor of law at Rutgers University Newark Law School and author of The Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. He joins us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. I'm very jealous of your weather.
Oh, yes, I know. We're enjoying it now, but it was cold earlier, but not like you guys. So what is the relationship between how we live in the United States, David, and where we live in the United States?
Well, it's really been a truism of American life. In fact, it's at the core of the American dream that place determines a lot of opportunity. We are a land of rugged individualists. We like to pride ourselves on a sense of self-sufficiency and not receiving handouts. But notwithstanding all of that, we also know the three rules of real estate: location, location, location. Mm-hmm. And we abide by those rules almost religiously because we recognize that everything we make is made better by a stronger environment. And so where we live determines the quality of public services we receive, the robustness of the tax base, the quality of the schools, the fact that our neighbors are or are not professionals whose children are, say, motivated to learn, who come home to a house of books and talk and curiosity and support and not a lot of stress and not a lot of crime. So where we live can become an enormous help in stabilizing middle-class options. But the converse is also true. We can live in communities where stress is the norm, where public services are not terribly stable, where the tax base is struggling, where the institutions are weak, and where a general sense of fragility holds. And that can have a devastating effect on our own household financial stability and our sense of opportunity.
So let's talk about how all this happens, because people end up self-segregating in many U.S. communities, even when they don't profess any explicit racial or ethnic biases. They move because they're thinking they want good schools and good neighborhoods for their kids to grow up in.
Right. And you know, this is why location, location, location is really not a science, but a set of beliefs. It's very, very subjective, and therefore it's going to be riddled with stereotype and assumptions. And so the way that I structure the book is, rather than sort of a full-bore assault on Americans' views of residency and race and class, I try to structure it much more around the notions, the assumptions that guide most of our thinking. So as you were saying, you know, you want to live in an area with nice people. You want to live in a place that seems to reflect your values. But we have all sorts of conscious and unconscious codes for how we go about achieving that. And so if we see, I mean, study after study after study has shown, for instance, that most white Americans won't tolerate more than a certain percentage of African Americans in their communities. They feel uncomfortable. They worry about property values, crime, the quality of schools, et cetera. So the mere presence of blacks above a certain percentage, or the appearance, the perception of blacks above a certain percentage, devalues the market for that place in their eyes. And so they tend to make choices based on that. Now, is it necessarily true that, say, having 35% blacks in your community is going to devalue your investment in your home and the institutions you care about? No, it's not. But it can be made true. It can be made a self-fulfilling prophecy just by the strength of those beliefs and how widely they're shared. So we're working as a nation to get beyond some of those beliefs. But we haven't worked hard enough because we keep recreating these relationships and we keep living in communities that are, by and large, quite segregated.
And yet it seems that we really treasure what turns out to be a fallacy that we have moved beyond being a racist society.
Yeah, that's another of the assumptions that we have, that segregation is a thing of the past, and that whatever segregation exists currently merely reflects people's voluntary preferences. And, you know, we have rights of association, we have rights of travel under our Constitution. Why wouldn't people have the freedom to choose their neighbors in that sense, as long as they're not doing it in some invidious, racist way? But we may still be doing it, is the problem. And the proof is in the facts. One of the things we've seen, there's a terrific set of researchers whose work I rely on in part in the book, Myron Orfield and Thomas Luce, and they recently completed a study that shows the instability of integrated communities. And in fact, your own listening area is included there, as I recall. So what Orfield and Luce show is they show a couple of very interesting trends that really help to propel the book, demographic trends. And that is the movement of non-whites outside of central cities like Dallas and into the suburbs. And so that's interesting in and of its own right, and it would suggest the diversification of those suburbs. But what they also found was that although those suburbs have gotten more non-white, reaching in many respects, you know, the halfway point, 50%, 60%, what is equally true is that once they get above a certain point, the diversity rapidly falls off, and they segregate, and they become non-white municipalities. Hmm. So in other words, integration is a very unstable condition. So we're proud, if we're living in that moment of diversity, we're proud to see something that our grandparents didn't see. But by the same token, our children probably won't see it by the time they finish high school.
How has localism and local sovereignty become a sort of underground stand-in for racism?
So, yeah, in the book I argued, and this is really on top of more academic scholarship. The book is written more as a conversation, but in more academic scholarship on jurisprudential trends, I have argued that localism, whether we intended it or not, has been the jurisprudential successor to Jim Crow segregation. And what I mean by that is that first of all, let me define localism. So localism is simply the notion of local control. And it's not as important in Texas and other places in the Southwest. There are other means by which localities exercise control, but not in the strict jurisdictional form that is more commonplace in the Northeast and the Midwest. But nonetheless, when you're in a state like Ohio or Pennsylvania, you'll find unbelievable municipal fragmentation. You'll find hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands. I think Pennsylvania has over 2,000 municipalities. Each locality is a sovereign. Each locality has a variety of rights delegated by the state to police itself, to exercise land use authority, to run its own schools, to collect property taxes and pay for basic services. And this has always been a good thing for Americans because it reflects the notion that, look, we have a right to participate at the highest possible level. And that highest level, where our voices are most clearly heard, is at the local level, where we are more in contact with the institutions that are important to our lives. And so there's a very strong democratic piece to all of that, and I'm not trying to disturb that. What happens, though, in the 1960s and the 1970s is as Brown versus Board of Education has really finally taken hold in decrying separate but equal, in prohibiting it as an official state policy, and as demanding more integrated settings. And then the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s begin to create an enforcement apparatus that makes sure that that happens across the land equally, localities find new ways to achieve some of the same segregated ends. And they do it primarily through zoning and through other means that exclude people deemed undesirable. And so, but because they do it based on zoning and land use ordinances that say things like, well, we only want single-family homes here, we don't want renters, we only want homeowners, there's nothing racial about that. And because there's nothing racial about it, then under our constitutional system, if it's challenged, it only gets rational basis scrutiny, which means if the town that enacted the ordinance says, well, we were doing this because, you know, we have only so much fire protection to go around, and we just can't take the density that would come with multifamily homes, and so we wanted single-family homes because it lowers our costs and increases efficiency. The court says, fine. But the problem with it is that it also has the intended or unintended effect of excluding people of lower incomes who disproportionately tend to be people of color. So whether we intended this or not, and there's evidence for both, we have at least negligently recreated the spatial relationships of a Jim Crow past in far too many places. And this has led to a geography of opportunity across this country that is really quite familiar to most of us. You can tell when you're in that predominantly non-white area, and you know that it's not a place that's rich in opportunity, and you also know that the reverse is true.
Even decisions about things that seem completely unrelated, like whether or not to have a municipal transit system and where the routes will run, communities might say, well, we don't need that because everyone in our community already owns a car, whereas you can look at it on the flip side and say, well, no one who doesn't own a car can go to your community because they can't get to and from work if they live there.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. You know, this is becoming much more of an issue than we thought. I mean, the first time I think we came upon this as a nation and began to recognize that carlessness can be akin to homelessness was with Hurricane Katrina. I mean, there was quite a wake-up call in terms of allowing people who take having a car for granted to see just how dangerous life can become when you don't have a car. And that happened over a matter of days. But what happens not over days, but over weeks, months, years, and it's just a character of our lives, is this transportation piece, which connects us to opportunity, which connects us specifically to jobs. And because our landscape is changing, because people are, by and large, less dependent for employment on the central city, the transportation routes that we had built for the most part in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s assumed that you were going from a bedroom suburb into the city. Now we have all sorts of terrific employment corridors out in the suburbs. And if you don't have a car and you live either in the city or you live in one of those, more likely, in one of those inner ring older suburbs that are becoming, as I mentioned earlier, increasingly non-white, you may have a very difficult time finding, making your way to work, or making your way to work and home in time to pick up a kid from school, because the schedule that exists is so limited based on assumptions that, you know, are 40, 50 years old.
My guest is David Dante Trout. He's professor of law at Rutgers University Newark Law School and author of The Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Dante Trout, professor of law at Rutgers University Newark Law School and author of the new book, The Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org, or you can call in to join us at 1-800-933-5372. David, I want to talk just a little bit more about transportation before we move on. And there's also the issue of school choice, so that when a school is failing in districts here in North Texas, you sometimes have the opportunity to go to a school outside your geographic zone. But again, this is an option that really doesn't exist for people who don't have private transportation and or the time to get their kids to a school every day that may not be in their geographic neighborhood.
Yeah, this is a tough one. And it, you know, it's interesting how many reforms we've seen in education based on the, you know, the universally beloved ideal of choice. But then, you know, as we dig down into the details, we realize that, you know, many of us really don't have the same choices. And because of that skew, very well-meaning policies may wind up benefiting only the most capable and leaving an even greater pool of less capable, less connected, or people with fewer resources behind.
So people might say, look, we can only take care of ourselves, our families, our immediate community. But you point out here that we sort of neglect the larger community at our own expense, ultimately.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how influential the social compact has been at various points in American history. I mean, it's obviously a deeply rooted idea in our republic, but it's something that comes in and out of fashion. I think it's got to come back. I think the idea of a greater good has to come back. And I'm not just saying this on some sort of moral basis. I mean, in the book, I talk about something I call mutuality. I call it progressive mutuality. Martin Luther King merely called it mutuality. And another word for it might merely be interdependency. But we have in society today a growing interdependency, not just among places where neighboring towns, suburbs, cities, you know, have a much closer relationship to each other's well-being than was previously thought. I mean, previously they've sort of acted as competitors, as friendly competitors in this marketplace to see who could win out in terms of amenities and residences and tax bases and all. But now they come to realize that, you know, we lead regional lives, and the resources of one place can benefit the resources of another, and the problems of another place can easily leak into the problems of another. Well, we're also seeing that as people. I mean, often what happens to our places has happened to us as people, as households first. And so we're realizing that people that we used to think were not terribly important to our existence, and if they failed, well, what the heck, they didn't try hard enough, it was because of some defect in themselves. We need them now. We need their success. And this couldn't be more clearly demonstrated than just the basic fact that the United States is about to become a non-white nation. You know, that in 2011, more children were born to non-white parents than to white parents. Never happened before. In the country's 100 largest metropolitan areas, the majority of school children are already non-white. So when it comes to public education, at least, in our greatest population centers, we already have a non-white nation. Well, it's time now to make some of the promises of equality, shared sacrifice, and shared gains a reality, because we need the success of people who have historically struggled to succeed. We need it because we can't have Social Security without it. We need it because that's the labor market in the next few years. We need it because we want to compete globally with other strong nations. There are just many, many reasons why the fate of our neighbor much more impacts our own fate than we used to think. And so because so many of us are also experiencing instability, because it's harder to be middle class, it's not the first instinct we have. Often the first instinct we have is to make sure that we keep what we have and don't lose more. But at the same time, that sense of fragility, which is new for a lot of people, ought to help us to look around a little more and recognize, you know, this interdependency thing is real, and we need policies that reflect it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Neil in Dallas. Hello, Neil.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying the show.
Sure.
I want to throw this out, just playing devil's advocate, purely not to the emotional sense, but just sort of the reality of the situation. And that is that, and this goes for whites, this goes for non-whites, this just goes for everybody who has to work hard to pay their bills. I wonder if your guests might agree that some of the things that the current administration is doing, as far as trying to help those that are underserved, in my opinion, it seems that some of this, although well meant, is actually in some ways kind of locking them into generations where they count on this quote unquote help, again, both for whites and non-whites, and then it sort of takes some of the struggle or the incentive to work harder to get out of that. I have seen cases of that. I wonder what your guests think of that.
Just a second, Neil. Are you talking about like housing assistance and food aid, that sort
of
thing?
Well, yeah, because if we're talking about, you know, rising above our own economic status that we don't like, no matter what color we are or what job we have or where we live, if we want a single housing residence, it seems that government help, government housing, you know, and assistance, although some really in need of that, is so prevalent now that it's almost a problem that is inverse to its own solution.
Yeah, Neil, thank you so much for your question, and we'll get a response for you. What do you think about that, David?
Well, you know, I think this administration is kind of between a rock and a hard place on this. You know, we can all think of somebody who appears to be receiving some subsidy from the government that's undeserved or excessive to the point of encouraging a lack of motivation or something like that. But I think that as a general matter, those moments, those anecdotes are exaggerated. People are really struggling now. We have all sorts of evidence that people are really struggling. And one important measure of it is that people who are working are really struggling. So a lot of folks who receive government subsidies, either federal subsidies or that are newly in place since the Obama administration or pre-existed it, or state subsidies, are people who are oftentimes working part-time jobs, unpredictable shifts at two or three different places. And they're underemployed and they're underpaid and they're struggling to make ends meet, but they are working. They're working poor people. So from the standpoint of motivation, there's nothing wrong with that guy, right? That guy is really trying to pull his own weight, but he can't because not only are his wages very low and there's been a catastrophic illness in the house or life has just happened in some way to make things particularly difficult, things are unaffordable. You know, it's not like we've seen a drop-off in food prices or a drop-off in rent prices in most places. We haven't, even though most of us have seen a drop-off in our incomes. So I think right now, until more people are more stable, you know, I think most of these subsidies are helping most of their recipients just to tread water. You know, and so I tend to be less concerned that people are being disincentivized to do for themselves. But let me just add one other piece to it, and that's the cost piece. You know, the book is called The Costs of Inequality and a Vision. Well, the book is called The Price of Paradise, but it's The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. And what I think is sometimes forgotten is that, you know, for people whose motivations and sense of personal responsibility we worry about, I think we sometimes forget how much we're paying for their failure. You know, so it is almost tautological to say, well, you know, I'm tired of these folks. I'm tired of providing a welfare net for people who won't do for themselves. Because you're going to provide that safety net one way or the other. They're going to cost you. Murder is costly. Incarceration is costly. School failure is costly. It's not just costly in terms of what it costs to prosecute somebody and to pay for somebody in prison and all the rest of it, but it's costly in terms of lost opportunity, because that's somebody who really could have been a contributor had they had better resources. Why they don't have it, we could have an endless discussion about why they don't. But they don't. And it's costing you and me. And therefore, we should care to make sure they get better resources.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Rhonda in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. I wanted to just expand a little bit on the transportation issue. I went to college in Atlanta, and I left just as the public transportation system was going in. And it was primarily to get people, you know, from the inner city into the close suburbs. Well, as most of us know, a couple weeks ago, Atlanta was hit by a terrible snowstorm. Well, one of the issues, really the biggest issue was, is that the northern suburbs where you have to have a car to get out there for the jobs and such, that was an area that did not want to have public transportation come out there because they were so worried about the theys, the thems that were going to be able to come out and have access to the jobs and perhaps move into a different income level. Well, when the storm hit, many of those people were trapped on the highway and could not get back to their safe suburbs in the northern suburbs. Now, when I was there over 30 years ago, that was an area that I wouldn't dare go into because I'm an African-American woman, and those areas, quite frankly, were very, very dangerous for us to be there. Well, you know, people have access now, but they still find legal ways to try to box themselves out away from other people. But the thing is, when something happens, like a snowstorm or a Katrina, it affects all of us. When we moved out to Murphy 15 years ago, there was an opportunity for there to be like a commuter rail train here, but people voted it down because they did not want them to come out here to Murphy to take whatever they thought we had. And I just think it's that type of thinking that continues to go on in 2014 that harms all of us, so therefore most of us cannot progress to the next level.
What do you think about that, David?
Oh, Rhonda, that's a great point. Such a good point that it you're actually making me sad that I didn't spend more time on the transportation issue in the book. And so maybe you've given me the seed for the next book. I mean, if there are so many examples of what you're talking about. You know, the whole trolley car that used to be ubiquitous in American cities really dies out at the behest of all sorts of interests that want to preserve suburbs for nice people and not for immigrants and not for African Americans, you know, back at the early 20th century. The story of Detroit is very much a story of the General Motors and Ford saying, no, we don't want public transportation out to the suburbs. This will be a car culture. Our workers will buy our cars, and we will have roads and not rails. Robert Moses in New York, not extending bus lines, and in fact building highways that had low bridges so that buses could not come out and bring workers from the city who would then see it and aspire to live in those tony places. One could go on and on and on. You're absolutely right that transportation is one of those racially neutral looking, class neutral looking, very kind of, you know, brass tacks subjects that doesn't seem to be a repository for all these equity concerns, but it is. It really is. And the interesting thing, too, sort of back to this notion of interdependency, is that the best example of our interdependency is the climate. That any one of us, wherever we are, because of the car we drive, because of the fuels we consume, can contribute to planetary changes that affect all of us. And now, I think, especially after this winter, more and more Americans are recognizing how real this is and how each of us plays a role, and we're dependent on each other to wake up to this role. Well, the whole car issue is clearly at the heart of that. So, again, the transportation issue is very much related to our social relationships, our economic relationships, our sense of collective can-doism and progress. And, frankly, it's also related to what resources will be available to our grandchildren and the quality of the environment they live in.
What is inclusionary zoning and how can it work for communities?
So inclusionary zoning is one of the many techniques that have developed to overcome some of the barriers of exclusionary zoning, as particular zoning techniques to keep certain people and certain uses out, but also to, in a more progressive fashion, to overcome whatever other hurdles there are to social inclusion, social and economic inclusion. So an example of it I know San Francisco is famous for its inclusionary zoning ordinance. A number of places have them. When a developer builds, let's say, an apartment building, a market-rate condos, they apply for permits. And if there's an inclusionary zoning ordinance on the books in that particular municipality, then part of the permitting process would require that a certain percentage of units be made affordable to people whose incomes fall below some designated line. And that way, with the production of new housing, you ensure the production of affordability, especially since the market often works the other way, where the incentives for real estate investors are to build more and more condos, high-end condos, because they just earn a much greater profit. So what inclusionary zoning does at the level of public policy is it says to the market, look, we understand what the incentives are out there. We don't want to stop you from doing what you're doing, but we also don't want what you're doing to create that much more spatial inequality and keep driving people out of these newly developed communities. So there's a trade-off. In order to do that, you have to make sure that there's provision for affordability.
My guest is David Dante Trout, professor of law at Rutgers University Newark Law School. His new book is called The Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. As part of KERA's ongoing One Crisis Away initiative, we're speaking this hour with law professor David Dante Trout of Rutgers. His new book is called The Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality and a Vision for a More Equitable America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, we have an email here from Adrian who asks, will you address the issues of gentrification in adding to or taking away from segregation in our cities and neighborhoods? It seems that there is a benefit to gentrification in that it often leads to less segregated neighborhoods for a while, but once property values go up, resegregation occurs.
Yeah, that's unfortunately very much the pattern. And it's becoming clear, I think, for a long time. It wasn't so clear, because what is gentrification but the success of revitalization efforts, which are not easy to begin in the first place. So when you start to see them taking hold and turning an area around, it's natural to be pleased at the outcomes, only to find that 10 years down the road, there's been a lot of displacement as a result of people being priced out. There were also several studies early on that suggested people were not being financially displaced by gentrification, which, didn't square with reality, and over time we've learned that it's just not true in many places. So what do you do? Well, there's not a lot that you always can do, but you start by being aware of the situation, by recognizing that this is just yet another example of how fragile a condition integration is, and that if you really want it, if you want integration, economic and racial integration, you have to do a little more to ensure that it stays, because it's dependent upon so many other factors that go to our income, our resources, our access to jobs, et cetera. So you have to try to stabilize housing options for the people at risk of being displaced, which is hard to do. It's, you know, inclusionary zoning is one example of making sure that you don't dry up all the affordability in an area, excuse me, as it's being gentrified. There are urban land trusts. There are other land use and real estate devices that one might use to preserve a stock of affordable housing in an area that's being gentrified. But it's really got to be done actively. It's not something that can happen accidentally or hopefully, because those can be very rapid forces. I mean, people. I lived in such a community. In fact, I've lived in two different gentrified communities in New York City in the last about 12 years, and in each case, the changes occurred within about 3 years. I mean, it was extremely rapid. One of the other problems with it is that a lot of times these are older neighborhoods with older people of color, you know, in say the Northeast, we're talking about, you know, older black neighborhoods in Brooklyn with older people living in 150-year-old brownstones with lots and lots of maintenance costs. And they sell them for $1.5 million, $2 million, you know, something that was bought, you know, on a workman's salary, you know, in the 1970s for $10,000. Well, that person has never seen such wealth before, and they'd like to bequeath it, you know, to their grandchildren and such. And we don't want to frustrate that, because that's also very much what we do as Americans. We hold property to gain, and then we acquire wealth in that way, and we don't want to stop people from acquiring wealth by any means. So it's complicated. But it begins with a clear recognition and then affirmative policy attempts to preserve affordable housing stock.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Russ in Dallas on the phone now. Hello, Russ.
How are you today?
Great, thank you.
Good. We have a good connection?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Good. This is probably very tangential to your talk today, but I enjoyed a recent thing on KERA about Silicon Island, the idea that the uber rich, the IT gurus, would literally office and live offshore, possibly like in cruise liners and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering about, that seems like the ultimate isolation, the ultimate pullout. It's all for tax purposes. And a little bit I'm curious, you know, what your guest thinks about how services are going to be provided and how these people would believe services would be provided, the tax consequences of that to local communities that would lose that tax base, just all kinds of things tied up in that.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. I haven't heard of that, and it's you know, it's, I mean, it sounds like a good fodder for a movie. You know, what the uber wealthy do, of course, is to isolate themselves generally from the reach of taxing authorities, right? So there's a lot of privatization, there's a lot of sheltering of wealth, you know, through myriad forms, corporate forms, other wealth transfer forms that allow them to appear to be one thing and pay taxes on that appearance. So I'm not shocked that people would find new ways to do that. The other part of your question, though, is what's the effect on the communities that they may be leaving behind? And, you know, I don't know, because I don't know under our current system, other than an income tax, how much we rely on them. I think that, you know, that 1%, although it's very important to the economies of cities like New York, I think a lot of those folks already live in enclaves where their income, but for income taxes, is not really shared by most of the rest of us.
How important is it, David, that cities look at the federal minimum wage and compare it to what amounts to a living wage within not simply their own city boundaries, but within the broader region?
Well, I think a metropolitan living wage is a good idea. I think that, you know, a city living wage is certainly a terrific idea, not without its problems, but whose benefits outweigh the problems. We just don't know enough about the reality of the problems. We don't know how they'll come to pass, you know, whether they'll drive out employers, whether they'll lead to more unemployment. I think most of that stuff at this stage in the economic literature is mostly conjecture, but I don't think it's conjecture to be able to forecast what an impact it's going to have in lifting people out of poverty. So I would say for that reason that the benefits far outweigh the possible problems associated with it. But to limit it within the city limits, I think, is to ignore the regional character of labor markets and how important it is to give people options to get where they need to go to get the job they want to have. I think that works to the benefit of employers, ultimately, and certainly works to the benefit of employees. So since most of our lives really are led in a regional fashion where we rely upon different aspects of the metropolitan area to satisfy different needs and desires in our lives, I think it would be optimal to have a metropolitan living wage. Is it likely? Probably not. But that goes not just to perceived flaws in the idea, but also to the fact that we really don't have anything like metropolitan governance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of metropolitan areas are actually interstate. So we'd be dealing with the governments, or at least the state governments, of 1, 2, in the case of New York, you know, 3 states.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Lisa in Dallas. Hello, Lisa.
Hi. Yeah. So my comment really is that it feels like people like me who work in essential sorts of professions where, in my example, is that I don't get to have a snow day. I have to come into the city on snow days. I cannot afford to live in Dallas and in a safe neighborhood. I felt like when I was shopping for homes that it was either the uber-rich neighborhoods or the not-so-safe neighborhoods, and perhaps I wasn't here long enough to see the middle ground, but it seems like there's so much of a dichotomy that where did the middle class go to have the benefits of the city so that we don't have the long commutes and the frustrating processes that go along with that, where I would like to be a part of the voting body of the city that I work in. I want to be a living member of the community that I work in.
Really interesting question. Thanks, Lisa.
Very interesting question, Lisa, and a very real problem for Americans all across the country. I mean, we go where we can afford to be, but then we work where we can find work. And the twain rarely meet or don't meet enough. And one of the barriers to their meeting is the fact that we accept a certain very high level of economic imbalance. I mean, going back to the beginning of this discussion, suppose for a moment that we lived in a country that that was much more assiduously concerned with a kind of a fair share of affordability, so that you didn't have whole swaths of a metropolitan area that were just out of reach for a lower middle-income earner, but instead that there was a real concern at the planning level to make sure that there were areas that were affordable to people at all income levels, and that we didn't tolerate, except in rare instances, real concentrations of wealth, and we especially would not tolerate real concentrations of poverty. I mean, we have areas of extreme poverty all over metropolitan areas of this country where a census tract will have households like 50 to 60% of households with incomes below poverty. That's super concentrated poverty. It devastates an area. And then there'll be other areas where there's 3% poverty. So even on the question of a fair share of poverty, imagine a country where it was part of our political ethos to try to do away with those huge disparities because of the devastation that they bring, and to try to enact policies that provide for much more balance. You wouldn't have the problem that you have. Now, I know this sounds very utopian, but, you know, we have to begin from the ideal. We have to imagine the ideal and the benefits and the efficiencies that come from the ideal, especially when they're so close to a lot of American values, that, you know, by embracing the ideal, thinking about the ideal, talking about the ideal, you know, we are more open and imaginative about policies that start to get us there.
You know, we've focused a lot of this conversation on the resistance that residents might have to mixed income developments in communities. But I wonder how much businesses throw up roadblocks, because I'm just, you know, taking a guess here. But I would imagine that a Neiman Marcus would rather have a lot of wealthy people concentrated in one area, and maybe a dollar store would rather have a lot of lower income people concentrated in one area. And they do have lobbying power.
Sure. You know, I think it probably plays some role, not a lot, because you know, each has other concerns that cut the other way. You know, Neiman Marcus is not paying everybody executive salaries, and so they need people who will work at minimum wage to, you know, run the registers and stock the floor. And if those people have to take 2 hours to get to work, there's a much greater likelihood that, you know, people will miss work, and there will be gaps, and Neiman Marcus's reputation among its tonier customers will begin to fall. So even in that instance, you know, Neiman Marcus has an interest in making sure that the relevant labor market has reasonable access within, you know, reasonable proximity. So I think you're going to see some resistance, but for the most part, I don't think it's as big an issue. And let me suggest something else, which is kind of interesting and might be somewhat surprising to a lot of listeners. You know, when we talk about areas of concentrated poverty, we are almost exclusively talking about African-American poverty and Latino poverty. Concentrated poverty among Latinos is growing, not surprisingly, as their population grows in the country. But still, the largest number of poor people, that is, people whose incomes fall below the poverty line, are white in the United States. But one interesting feature of white poverty, one spatial feature of white poverty, is that the white poor almost never live in communities where, according to the census, more than 10% of the households are poor.
Wow.
They almost never do. Now, this there's a lot of things we can draw from this. But
you know, I'm so sorry that I have to jump in because we're at the very end of our hour, but that's given us a lot to think about.
Sure.
David Dante Trout is professor of law at Rutgers and author of The Price of Paradise, The Costs of Inequality, and A Vision for a More Equitable America. He joined us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. David, really, really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure. And thanks to the listeners who called in.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.